There are only two types of people in the world. Those who believe in Sasquatch and those who do not. You know Sasquatch, that mythical, maybe or not, figure who lives in the Pacific Northwest, maybe, or in Branson, Missouri, possibly, or somewhere in Georgia, perhaps. These are all places where people have reported sightings of the man, the myth, the legend, Sasquatch himself. I saw a couple nudges this way. Do we have any true believers of Sasquatch in the house? There we go. There we go. Oh, well, everyone else, it's good to know when you're wrong. But with Sasquatch, it's kind of interesting because the way that most of us in the modern world, at least, think about Sasquatch is parallel and similar to how many people think about God, isn't it? That there are some people, well-intentioned but perhaps misguided, who believe in some mythical figure, Jesus or someone or something that may or may not be there. And that's fine so long as it doesn't get too weird or crazy or violent or anything like that. It's just a cute little game. And then the rest of us have sort of matured beyond those silly sorts of beliefs and those types of figures, particularly ones that, you know, live around or emerge around holidays and things. I won't say anything to, no spoilers here, but that's how most people in the modern world think about Jesus. And we're exploring these perspectives and understandings and assumptions in this series that we're calling Questioning Christianity, where we're looking at some of the questions and objections and assumptions that emerge in relationship to faith, and questions around religion itself or science or the Bible or justice and diversity, or a number of other, or women in ministry and leadership. How do we, in the modern world, engage these topics that are, in many ways, the question is somehow decided for us in advance by some folks in the modern world? And so today we're going to look at this question: hasn't science disproved Christianity? You know, a Pew Research Center survey reported in 2021 that 56% of Americans believe that there is a pretty significant conflict between science and religion in general, but Christianity in particular. And most people think that the scientific revolution that has happened over the course of the past 500 years or so has put to rest any questions of matters of faith, in particular of Christianity. With, you know, we open up the Bible and there's all sorts of things that are very difficult to empirically prove or justify in the context of even just the first few pages of the Bible. So how do we understand and engage in a conflict and in conversation people? If you're a follower of Jesus and you don't believe that there's a conflict, the odds are that you have friends or children or grandchildren who are convinced that that is in fact not the case, and that you're a kind of Sasquatch-believing-like person. Happy Sunday, that's how people think about you. But is it that straightforward and simple, or is it a little more complex and complicated than that? I was thinking about this this week in what I think is God's mischief, that I'm thinking about this question of science and Christianity, and there's a solar eclipse. And so I take my kids to the Downing Planetarium. Beckett was very, very interested in the solar eclipse, and Berkeley was very, very passionately disinterested in the solar eclipse. So that, you know, that seems about right. But we were looking at the solar eclipse with hundreds of other people at the Downing Planetarium, and there's, you know, astrophysicists talking about, you know, the correlation between the stuff and the things, and, you know, how it happens very rarely. It's not going to happen again for a while. The Path of Totality, which sounds like a great band name, and all of that stuff. It was so fun and exciting and energizing, and, you know, you get the cool glasses to, you know, put in the scratch and all that. It's super fun. But no one was out there saying, do you know what this means? It's going to be a great year for our crops. Exactly. Or, you know, the gods are on our side going into battle against our enemies. Right? In a pre-scientific worldview, that's what an eclipse could have meant for people. It meant something. There were, the cosmos were communicating something from a transcendent realm to us mere mortals, that it was up to us to sort of read the cosmic tea leaves and the signs in the sky to figure out how this all worked together. But we don't think like that anymore in the modern world. And even those of us who are faithful followers of Jesus don't think that way necessarily either. So, has science, in fact, disproved Christianity? What is this that we're doing here? Let's look at Romans 1, 18 through 21 to see if it might be a little more complex than that. So, Romans 1, beginning of verse 18, which will be up here on the screens. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. That just, by the way, isn't what the eclipse meant either, just putting it out there. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Now, Paul here is writing a letter to a church in the heart of the Roman Empire that is comprised of Jewish followers of Jesus and Gentile or Roman, Greco-Roman followers of Jesus. And in the time before, Paul establishes this community, and a time when the Roman Empire was kind of opposed to the Jewish religious structure there in the city, and all of the Jewish followers of Jesus were kicked out and exiled from the city of Rome. And then after a number of years, they were brought back in, and this community of Jewish Gentile Christians was formed and trying to figure out how to do life together and in this multi-ethnic, really cool, beautiful type of community in the heart of the Roman Empire. But the background context is that their culture is opposed to their existence. The structure of this community just doesn't compute with the values and assumptions of this culture. And Paul here in chapter 1 is writing directly and expressly to the Gentile perspective. And to be sure, he's going to make the same argument, leverage the same argument against the Jewish followers of Jesus here in a little while. But his main argument here is that the relational and societal and internal dysfunction that results in broken relationships and broken systems in the world that the Bible calls sin, that is a result from humanity's rejection of God. Pretty straightforward and simple argument. But Paul's making that argument based on the claim that within the world as it is, within the natural world, God has made God's self evident. God has provided evidence and clues and signs and realities that point to God's presence, his invisible qualities being made visible in natural phenomenon. But Paul's claim is simply that both Gentiles and Jews alike have fundamentally just ignored the evidence. Yeah, I'd prefer to live life as if there were no God, or as if the God that is revealed in and through Jesus in particular, and the scriptures in general. Yeah, that's not really the way I understand the world to work, or that's not really how I want the world to work. And so, because I either don't understand it, or don't want to comprehend it, or don't want to live in the sort of the mold that this worldview forces me into, or invites me into, I'm just going to reject it and push it away and say, you know, that's not really for me. The language that Paul uses here is the wrath of God, and that's a fun thing for, you would expect someone like me up here doing stuff like this to say, the wrath of God is against you. And really what Paul is saying there is that this is just the natural consequences of this type of rejection of the way of God in the world, of looking at the evidence and saying, you know what, no thank you. And the result of that is things like anxiety and depression and loneliness and family breakdown and all sorts of just things that seem normal. Paul says from a theological lens, those things are all the result of rejecting God. And what's interesting, though, is not just what's happening in the first century world around this rejection of the evidence of God, but the way in which our world in the 21st century is built on some of the founding assumptions that were happening in the Greco-Roman world at that time. So the best way to understand the world that you and I live in, the water that we swim in, is through a delightful little acronym called WEIRD. We live in a weird world, and by that, I mean, we live in a Western world, a world that is primarily influenced by and understood according to a Western cultural lens, that the predominant view that all of us view reality through is Western, shaped by the Latin-speaking base of this culture that you and I live in. It's enlightened. And this is shaped by a movement that happened around 500 years ago that developed into a sort of assumption or a desire to remove or subtract God from a view of reality. And this was primarily politically motivated. Because back in the day, you know, kings were, you know, divine right and all that stuff. And so in order for people to have more power and influence, like, you can't argue against the fact that, well, God says that this person has authority. So if you take away God, then you take away that person's authority, and then you get some for yourself. So that works out quite well, if that's what you want to do. And then we move into industrialized. So the world that we live in is fundamentally shaped by, at a technological but also at a sociological level, by the Industrial Revolution. And, you know, part and parcel to the way that machines work and are engineered together, we have a mechanistic view of reality as a result of the influence of the Industrial Revolution. And that Industrial Revolution led to a immense amount of wealth in the Western world in particular, and in the United States especially, that most of the problems that most people throughout most of human history have had to deal with, we have no relationship with at all because of the affluence with which our country exists in. And finally, it's democratic, that our assumption about the world is that each individual has a role in shaping the whole. Now, all of these things are weird from a pre-modern perspective who believes in a God, a transcendent order, supernatural reality, and all of that. But these are just simply default assumptions that we just are born into the world thinking that this is how things are. And you all probably do not spend any time thinking about any of this stuff, and that's totally fine most of the time. And it's just in times and conversations like this when it's opportune to hold up a mirror to say, are the beliefs that you hold actually yours? Or were they given to you? Were you given a view of reality that shaped how you understood it? A pair of glasses that frames how you see what you see? And could there, in fact, be more to the story than what first meets the eye? Could reality itself be actually way weirder than this? Could there be something more going on here? Now, this all leads to, and CJ, I'm going to jump here a couple of slides to the one with the Bible and the microscope. So this all leads to, for us, the shaping of reality leads us to kind of see this tension between a scientific worldview and a biblical worldview. And this language of worldview just simply means how you look at life and reality, you're just the basicness of life. Our brains are organized in such a way to try and reduce the amount of thinking that we have to do on a given day. So like our brains want to be on autopilot as much as possible. So we want to have these assumptions. And so, but we bring these assumptions with us when we go to the Bible itself. And so when we open up the Bible, which looks, assume, because it looks just like any other book that you would have on a shelf in your library or on an app on your phone, we assume that because it looks this way, it can be read and comprehended the same way that you read and comprehend every other book. So you start where? At the beginning. Okay, in the beginning, God created the earth. Whoa. Wait, was it 6 days that this happened? Like, that's what it says. Or was that 6 days representative of number of thousands of years? Or was it 13.8 billion years since the Big Bang? What do we do with that? How do we know when to take the Bible literally on these things when it comes into conflict of science and religion? Well, the good news, my friends, is that you can come back next week, and Dr. Tim Getter is going to sort all of that out for you then. But the question remains, you get past that, and then you've got a talking snake. And then you get past that, and you've got this story of these 10 plagues that are happening, like natural reality is somehow being manipulated by God. And then there's this story about a floating axe head, and you know, all these. You just keep reading, and there's story after story after story of like things that just create a sense of cognitive dissonance for us in the modern world of like, how can I expect to know what this is about? Do I have to suspend my disbelief in order to engage toward a mode of belief? How does any of this even work? We approach this with a hermeneutic, a way of understanding and reading of suspicion, a of it could this be, rather than of trust and belief. We read this scripture, this story, through the lens of our 21st century cultural context. And that's where everybody begins. Everybody reads from their own cultural context. The challenge becomes, how do we let this story, from its cultural context, read us in our cultural context, and the assumptions that we bring here? How do we position ourselves to best open ourselves to this kind of knowing and understanding? Well, Paul continues in verse 20, and he says, "For since the creation of the world, whatever you believe about how that happened or not," here's what Paul is saying, here's what the creation of the world means and is and does. It makes visible God's character. There's something about the natural world that is a clue into who God is and what God is like. And these things have been clearly seen. You can just walk out the door right now and look up at the phenomenon of rain, which is a rare sighting for us here. And say, what does this mean? What does this communicate to us about the nature and heart of God? That's not a question we normally ponder while it's drizzling on our heads. But what does it mean? And I think about this question a lot because I've had this amazing experience that has never been unparalleled. One of my favorite things to do, and it's been a while since I've done this, but is to drive people who have never been to Yosemite Valley in the southern entrance through the tunnel into Inspiration Point. It's the best case scenario if it's winter. And to a person, it is like you can't hold it back. Every single, and even in myself, it's a physiological response. You come out that tunnel, and you see the valley, and you say, oh my God. Oh my God. And the claim of the scriptures is like, yes, that's right. That's who did that. And all of the like sort of reductionistic explanations of what that is and how it got to be like that and how it could look like that. You know, a glacier slowly carved its way through the valley over a period of thousands of years as the temperatures on the earth began to cool, and it created, you know, the force, the physical force of the glacier. It's like, Yeah. That's so cool. That's amazing that happened that way. But what does it mean? Like, why do we look at this and say, oh my God? What does this communicate to us about the type of God that we have, about his eternal power? That you stand at the base of El Capitan and just look up in awe and reverence. What does that mean? Or my 4.5-year-old son Beckett loves Wild Kratts. Any Wild Kratts fans? We spend a lot of time hanging out with the Kratt Bros, who explore the world and ask questions and take on the powers, the creature powers that the world has. And the one that I consistently come back to is just like, this is mind-boggling to me, is bioluminescence. Like bioluminescence, that in the deepest, darkest parts of the ocean, there are creatures who have never seen light at all, but somehow their bodies are capable of producing light, which they can't even see. It's mind-boggling. It is utterly fascinating. What does this communicate to us about the character and nature of God? I mean, a simple layup of an explanation is like, maybe God is the type of God who desires to produce some sort of light in the deepest, darkest realities of the world and of your life. You can look at a jellyfish and come to all sorts of conclusions about what's going on here in the world. And part of this development, I mean, we can look at all of this stuff and we can look at all the explanations, and I get them. I appreciate them. I like learning about them. But they reduce the truth to just a small sliver of reality. But what's fascinating to me is that the development of science itself emerges from within the Christian, within Christian theology. The fundamental assumption that science is predicated upon is that reality, nature itself, is knowable. That we can understand it, that we can comprehend it, that we can learn more about it. And why would that be, that's not just a given. Like, why would we come to that understanding, that knowledge? Well, because it was first influenced by the fact that reality was itself was created by a relational being who desires to be known. And that we can use these different methodologies and tools to come to a greater understanding of the world, which gets us then to the question of why. Why do things have to be this way? It could have been otherwise, but it's this way. The universe is so fine-tuned to like a mind-boggling degree that the odds of the universe being positioned as they are to produce life as it is are about the same as it would be to hand a monkey a typewriter and for that monkey to produce the entire corpus of Shakespeare perfectly on the first try. That is mind-boggling. And whether or not you jump to the conclusion of an intelligent designer behind that or not, it's amazing. So this emerges out of Christian theology, and a sociologist of Christianity named Ravi Stark lodges this here, and he says, the Christian image of God is that of a rational being who believes in human progress, more fully revealing himself as humans gain the capacity to better understand. And moreover, because God is a rational being and the universe is his personal creation, it necessarily has a rational, lawful, stable structure awaiting increased human comprehension. This was the key to many intellectual undertakings, among them the rise of science. So all of this is just what theologians call general revelation. That God is revealed and known through just general phenomenon and natural phenomenon in the world. But that doesn't get us all the way there. And so scriptures then are what theologians call specific or particular revelation, where all of this kind of comes to a head. And within this is this vision of Jesus, who clearly reveals the heart of God, who demonstrates what it means for the creator of the world to interact with the creation itself, both physical beings and physical reality, Jesus walking on water and calming storms and raising people from the dead, and all of these what we would call miraculous things that follow from the fact that God, who exists outside of space and time and matter, has come into space and time and matter in the person and work of Jesus Christ as what C.S. Lewis called the grand miracle. This is the greatest of all phenomenon in the world. And he writes this, that the Christian story is precisely the story of one grand miracle. The Christian assertion being that what is beyond all space and time, what is uncreated, eternal, came into nature, into human nature, descended into his own universe, and rose again, bringing nature with him. So now we can know in and through nature, and particularly in and through Jesus, what the heart of God is like. And that heart is self-sacrificial, other-oriented, community-creating, enemy-embracing love. That's what reality itself is. And it's up to us to align ourselves with this reality, to live in line with what Jesus shows us about who God is. And so in many ways, science doesn't disprove God. In many ways, it reveals the truth of God and our need for God. But the challenge, my friends, as we conclude here, is that what Paul writes in verse 21 is that although we humans knew God, we neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him as God. The human condition is such that we walk through the world with a primary disposition of ingratitude. We just take for granted the miracle of life, the miracle of other people existing, that we get this moment in time in human history to be here in the present with each other, with these challenges and opportunities in front of us. And so the question I think that this begs and invites us into is, with all of these assumptions, with all of this, the world behind us kind of forcing our vision into a narrow, specific way of viewing reality, the question is, do we ourselves need a Copernican revolution of our lives? You know, the Copernican revolution was one that took the Earth from the mental model of reality as being the center of the solar system of the universe and put the sun back in its proper place as the center of the solar system. And as I think about that often, I think about the fact that I try to undo that revolution all the time by putting myself at the center of all reality. That my experience, my assumptions, my desires, my preferences, me, myself, and I exist at the center of all things. And this is predominantly the problem that the scriptures in general, and Jesus in particular, reveals to us and provides us with a way by grace through faith in trusting that there is another way of being human, a better way of being human that makes you increasingly capable of loving other people as marked by those who are different from you. The theologian, when it comes to all of these sort of apologetic arguments about science and religion and faith and all of this stuff and making a case for the credibility of faith, which there is a strong one, it all comes down to this. I can present you with any argument, any data, facts, or figures, or whatever, but the only thing that truly and ultimately matters, the only thing that's truly credible is love. Is self-sacrificial, other-oriented, community-creating, enemy-embracing love. That's the only thing that is credible. It's the only thing that matters. So are you becoming, is the worldview that you live with, is the way you engage in understanding all things, is it making you more capable of loving other people? How can we begin to live with gratitude and wonder at the world? I'm going to give you three quick suggestions as we close. The first is something called Lectio Scientia. Lectio Scientia. Lectio Divina is a way of reading the Bible slowly, meditatively, listening for a word, a phrase, or image from God. You can do this with science as well. I did it with pictures from the Hubble telescope this week. It's amazing. You just sit with an image or a scientific study and just meditate on it and ask, God, what does this reveal about your heart and your character? Try it. Second, why don't you apply the scientific method to Jesus' golden rule hypothesis? What if you lived an entire day trying to put somebody else's needs before your own? And see if that actually makes your life a little bit better? And then finally, which gift of life can you say thank you for? As you, maybe it's the rain, maybe it's your family, maybe it's your kid who's getting under your nerves, or maybe it's that ache in your back, or whatever. What can you say thank you for that gets you in tune with the wonder and awe that flows from knowing that there is a God who created all of this and who created you to know this God in and through Jesus and to live a life of love in the world? So may we do this, my friends. Let me close us in prayer. God, we thank you for the ways that you reveal yourself in and through microscopes and telescopes, through our senses and our perceptions, that you desire to be known and discovered, that you have created us for relationship and love with you. Help us to put the sun at the center of our own solar systems so that we can live with increasing love for others in the world. We pray all of this in Jesus' name. Amen.